Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 151, Some True History, Part 6, the concluding part to this series. Book, part of Beacon Press's Revisioning series, An Indigenous People's History of the United States by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. Very in-depth and thorough and highly significant telling of history and how it's affecting today's world. And this show, the part 6, summing up what can be done to help change directions. Throw in a kind of personal note. There's many ways to go about reading up about Native peoples. There's the history, and then there's also the sort of philosophy, the culture, the lifestyle, and much having to do with any particular nation or tribe. So there's a variety of angles if you have a further interest, which you can explore. And the point being that there are tons of books out there to further educate and learn in this age of Native literature making great strides. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening. Part 6, chapter conclusion, and called The Future of the United States. And the chapter, about 20 pages, has some solutions, which most welcome after a book of hearing about all the atrocities and horrors of the history. One begs for solutions, even though I think I've heard that in Lakota, words like solutions and goals may not exist, so it's a different way of looking at how you go about that. But we'll share some of what she shares, and then the acknowledgments. Actually, typically think of acknowledgments as respectively boring pages in a book, but these are probably the best acknowledgments pages I have ever read. Before getting into the last chapter, I wanted to give my little summary, because while reading the book, you know, with anything, I try to sum up things in a short amount of almost like haiku style sum up things, which is not meant to oversimplify or disrespect all the facts, but in an effort to, you know, sometimes somebody asks what's the essence of a book, or to try to remember the essence of something, it helps to have a short way to do that. So, what I came up with from reading this book there's a four parts, and number one, to show the sort of course of events in history, settler colonialism as a way to describe, you know, what happened with Turtle Island, settler colonialism. And then number two, genocide via extermination and or assimilation, both having to do with the other. And then towards the mid to late 1800s, the populist imperialism, which I now see as one of the main mindsets that is still prevalent in today's world, in today's empire, and with the current elections, showing how strong that mindset is. And populist imperialism is partly European old world roots, from the European old world roots to the global corporate empire tentacles, meaning that this attitude kind of came over from Europe and now it's spread around the world and in different shapes and forms. And then four, what we're going to get into, the solutions. So starting with book sort of pathway of history, settler colonialism, genocide, on to populist imperialism, and then solutions. And genocide meaning, you know, there's the extermination and the assimilation, because that's still a big issue too. We see that in a lot of stuff, where sometimes native governments and native chiefs or whatever get sell out to the powers that be and the deals that are offered. So that's an ongoing issue as well. Anyway, on to the chapter, and starts off with a quote from Jody Bird, that the continued colonization of American Indian nations, peoples, and lands provides the United States the economic and material resources needed to cast its imperialist gaze globally is a fact that is simultaneously obvious within and yet continually obscured by what is essentially a settler colony's national construction of itself as an ever more perfect multicultural, multiracial democracy. The status of American Indians as sovereign nations colonized by the United States continues to haunt and inflect its raison d'etre. Now, one other thing I find there fascinating, which from other readings in this vein, is the that more perfect multicultural, multiracial democracy. That gets, you know, the melting pot of America, as I learned of it in high school books, and it's like this welcoming of all different peoples and nations, and it gets touted as so kind and benevolent in that way, and in a way it is. I honor that. But then on the other hand, you have very strong, you know, disregard and sort of out of the conversation when it comes to the native peoples. That's changing, but I think that's the gist of where that's coming from. And here she's talking about a book by Robert D. Kaplan in 2005 called Imperial Grunts. Presented several case studies that he considered highly successful operations: Yemen, Colombia, Mongolia, and the Philippines. Also Horn of Africa, Afghanistan, and Iraq. And there's a section in this, my note is, very telling of their psychology. By the turn of the 21st century, the U.S. military had already appropriated the entire earth and was ready to flood the most obscure areas of it with troops at a moment's notice. The Pentagon divided the planet into five area commands, similar to the way that the Indian country of the American West had been divided in the mid-19th century by the U.S. Army. According to the soldiers and Marines I met on the ground in far-flung corners of the earth, the comparison with the 19th century was apt. "Welcome to Indian country" was the refrain I heard from troops from Colombia to the Philippines, including Afghanistan and Iraq. To be sure, the problem for the American military was less Islamic fundamentalism than anarchy. The war on terrorism was really about taming the frontier. So it sure helps explain why, you know, still much of the native way is squelched, because, you know, once you uncover that and you see that pattern, it helps to connect the dots and what's going on today. And as mentioned in another show, sort of the insane reversal of the truth, where this is somebody quoted as responsible for crimes they committed against any U.S. soldier. Quote, as a result, citizens of American Indian nations become in this moment the origin of the stateless terrorist combatant within U.S. enunciations and sovereignty. Has to do with the way the combatants, whatever the labeling is nowadays regarding terrorists. And I had mentioned the killing of the sheep and the goats. I think it was the Navajo sheep and goats, as similar to the buffalo of the Plains Indians as part of the warfare. And here it is mentioned, this has to do with the Chagossian Islands and Diego Garcia, as if being rounded up and removed from their homelands in the name of global security were not cruel enough. Before being deported, the Chagossians had to watch as British agents and U.S. troops herded their pet dogs into sealed sheds where they were gassed and burned. And that's the, there you have Nazi, what I call Nazi behavior. And that has to, all had to do with to create a military base. And there's a new book out, recent book out by David Vine about the, I think it's called Base Nation. And here he writes, there's a quote, the base on Diego Garcia has become one of the most secretive and powerful U.S. military facilities in the world, helping to launch the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq twice, threatening Iran, China, Russia, and nations from southern Africa to Southeast Asia, host to a secret CIA detention center for high-profile terrorist suspects, and home to thousands of U.S. military personnel and billions of dollars in deadly weaponry. So there's the empire at work. The Chagossians, however you pronounce, are not the only indigenous people around the world that the U.S. military has displaced. The military established a pattern during and after the Vietnam War of forcibly removing indigenous peoples from sites deemed strategic for the placement of military bases. And then here's in response to one reporter's question, Secretary of State Henry Kissinger said of the Micronesians, quote, there are only 90,000 people out there. Who gives a damn? End quote. Now, you know, you got to consider that both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have met with Kissinger. So, you know, that speaks a lot there. And continuing, by the beginning of the 21st century, the U.S. operated more than 900 military bases around the world, including 287 in Germany, 130 in Japan, 106 in South Korea, 89 in Italy, 57 in the British Isles, 21 in Portugal, and 19 in Turkey. The number also comprised additional bases or installations located in Aruba, Australia, Djibouti, Egypt, Israel, Singapore, Thailand, Kyrgyzstan, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Crete, Sicily, Iceland, Romania, Bulgaria, Honduras, where Hillary helped overthrow democratically elected leader Zelaya, Colombia and Cuba, Guantanamo Bay, among many other locations in some 150 countries, along with those recently added in Iraq and Afghanistan. In her book, The Militarization of Indian Country, excellent book, Anishinaabe activist and writer Winona Duke analyzes the continuing negative effects of the military on Native Americans. New Mexico bristles with nuclear weapons storage, and Shoshone and Paiute territories in Nevada are scarred by decades of above-ground and underground nuclear testing. The Navajo Nation, the Diné, and some New Mexico pueblos have experienced decades of uranium strip mining and the pollution in water and subsequent deadly health effects. So, you know, these are the one of the wonders of this book is that because these are so much the untalked about things. First of all, the just write out their statistics of what makes up an empire, and then, you know, the horrors of the land, air, and protecting of land, air, and water, and health issues that go along with the scorched earth policy, full spectrum dominance, whatever you want to call it. Then it goes into the populist imperialism, has to do with the, quoting somebody else in here, another book, enduring appeal of the romanticized myth of the settlement, not the conquest of the frontier, either by actual men such as Robert Rogers or Daniel Boone, or fictitious ones like Nathaniel Bumpo of James Fenimore Cooper's creation, points to what D.H. Lawrence called the myth of the essential white America. And then a section called North America is a Crime Scene. And Jody Bird, again quoting her, what is essentially a settler colony's national construction of itself as an ever more perfect multicultural, multiracial democracy, while the status of American Indians as sovereign nations colonized by the U.S. continues to haunt and inflect its raison d'etre. Here, Byrd quotes Lakota scholar Elizabeth Cook Lynn, who spells out the connection between the Indian Wars and the Iraq War. The current mission of the U.S. to become the center of political enlightenment to be taught to the rest of the world began with the Indian Wars and has become the dangerous provocation of this nation's historical intent. The historical connection between the Little Bighorn event and the uprising in Baghdad must become part of the political dialogue of America if the fiction of decolonization is to happen and the hope for deconstruction of the colonial story is to come about. Decolonizing, that's one of the solutions given, whether it's decolonizing the mind and, you know, the physical decolonizing. And Dunbar Ortiz writes, a settler society that has not come to terms with its past. This legacy of settler colonialism can be seen in the endless wars of aggressions and occupations, the trillions spent on the war machinery, bases, and personnel instead of social services and quality public education, the gross profits of corporations, each of which has greater resources and funds than more than half the countries in the world, yet pay minimal taxes and provide few jobs for U.S. citizens, the repression of generation after generation of activists who seek to change the system, the incarceration of the poor, particularly descendants of enslaved Africans, the individualism carefully inculcated that on the one hand produces self-blame for personal failure and on the other exalts ruthless dog-eat-dog competition for possible success, even though it rarely results in high rates of suicide, drug abuse, alcoholism, sexual violence against women and children, homelessness, dropping out of school, and gun violence. And then, a book called The Commonwealth. She refers to the medieval European concept of the commons as an aspiration for contemporary social movements. Now, there's a positive aspect to this. I think, see, the commons, oh, that sounds really good, and in some ways it is, but yet again, from the native perspective, see it differently. Most writings about the commons barely mentions the fate of indigenous peoples in relation to the call for all land to be shared. Two Canadian scholar activists, Nandita Sharma and Cynthia Wright, for example, do not mince words in rejecting native land claims and sovereignty, characterizing them as xenophobic elitism. They see indigenous claims as regressive neo-racism in light of the global diasporas arising from oppression around the world. So, you could see that happen with the Occupy movement where, you know, it took a while, and I know at some point New York Occupy movement was not welcoming the native people's perspective. And you're talking about people occupying, but then, in effect, the natives are saying, it's already occupied. So, are you occupying the occupier? We want to unoccupy and regain, you know, what is ours is from the native perspective. So, it's a tricky stuff. And, you know, as with the Whitman, this whole commons thing, you know, it sounds good on the surface, but from the native perspective, looking deeper shows a layer of truth. And she talks about a certain psychological denial of say, anthropological findings and people excited about that, but you know, she says anything but Indians, for that would provide evidence reminding Anglo settlers' descendants that the continent was stolen, genocide committed, and the land repopulated by settlers who seek authenticity but never find it because of the lie they live with, suspecting the truth and fearing it. And going back to the, which put a dent in the NRA here, this whole, the War Department and the chief reason for the War Department's purchases of the rifle in great quantities to kill Indians. The rifle was a technological innovation designed especially for the U.S. Army's campaigns against the Plains Indians following the Civil War. So, you know, the whole right to bear arms with a well-regulated militia being a key phrase there, but to see some of the origin of that, the right to bear arms to do what? There's some house that the Winchester, Mrs. Winchester has some famous house, which is like umpteen core secret trap doors and hide the stairways. It's one of those like amazing designed houses, but she writes, Mrs. Winchester might have been more aware of the truth than most people and therefore fearful of its consequences. Regardless, in continuing to find or invent enemies across the globe, expand what is already the largest military in the world, and add to an elaborate global network of military bases all in the name of national or global security, does not the U.S. today resemble Mrs. Winchester constantly trying to foil her ghosts? The guilt harbored by most is buried and expressed in other ways on a larger scale as regeneration through violence, in Richard Slotkin's phrasing. That's a whole psychological show could do there, that phrase, regeneration through violence. So it's interesting, again, showing Dunbar Ortiz is not just a history book. She's showing this level of metaphor and how things play out in the culture. This Mrs. Winchester, this wife or descendant of the inventor of the Winchester rifle, showing how she has this house that was built, or inherited and added to, and all these sort of, the way she describes it, parlors and bedrooms, kitchens and closets, blah, 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 and showing how that's kind of like a metaphor for the confusion of, if you look at all the organizations, you know, a lot more since 9/11 with the Homeland Security and all the bureaucracy, it is very much that kind of whack haunted house that she describes in here. So very, very interesting comparison based on reality, you know, based on true story. Fascinating stuff. And the last page of the book, titled The Future. So might as well just read this. How then can U.S. society come to terms with its past? How can it acknowledge responsibility? The late Native historian Jack Forbes always stressed that while living persons are not responsible for what their ancestors did, they are responsible for the society they live in, which is a product of that past. Assuming the responsibility provides a means of survival and liberation. Everyone and everything in the world is affected, for the most part negatively, by U.S. dominance and intervention, often violently through direct military means or through proxies. It is an urgent concern. Historian and teacher Juan Gomez Quinones writes, American Indian ancestries and heritages ought to be integral to K-12 curriculums and university explorations and graduate expositions, with full integration of Native American histories and cultures into academic curriculums. Gomez Quinones coins a measure of intelligence in the U.S., the indigenous quotient, IQ. Indigenous peoples offer possibilities for life after empire, possibilities that neither erase the crimes of colonialism nor require the disappearance of the original peoples, colonized under the guise of including them as individuals. Assimilation. That process rightfully starts by honoring the treaties the United States made with indigenous nations, by restoring all sacred sites, honoring treaties, education, restoring sacred sites, starting with the Black Hills and including most federally held parks and land and all stolen sacred items and body parts, and by payment of sufficient reparations for the reconstruction and expansion of Native nations. In the process, the continent will be radically reconfigured physically and psychologically for the future to be realized. It will require extensive educational programs and the full support and active participation of the descendants of settlers, enslaved Africans, and colonized Mexicans, as well as immigrant populations. So really, you know, nice call for the settlers to be settler allies and to own up to their own lineage's history, whether they were part of it or not, and to see education across the board. And, you know, as many of the U.S. political populace sees the expenses, you know, what could be done for infrastructure, social services, education, healthcare, the monies that go to the military, obviously that could be rerouted to, you know, helping with the native peoples as well. And she wraps up with, in the words of Acoma poet Simon Ortiz, "The future will not be mad with loss and waste, though the memory will be there. Eyes will become kind and deep, and the bones of this nation will mend after the revolution." Or I might add, evolution, as some native peoples accentuate, as revolution sort of winds up in a circular sense, it winds up where one was, but just things have changed, whereas evolution has a true sense of progress. Now the acknowledgments. There's a couple pages. I'll see if I can read this. I have dedicated this book to Vine DeLorean Jr., Jack Forbes, and Howard Adams, three late indigenous activist scholars who pioneered the development of Native American studies programs and scholarship in universities in the 1970s. My mentor and a mentor and an inspiration to many, Vine DeLoria Jr., 1933 to 2005, Yankton, Dakota of the Great Sioux Nation, impressed upon me the necessity for indigenous sovereignty to be the framework and groundwork for the decolonization of Native American history. Sovereignty, he argued, is not only political, but a matter of survival, and the denial of sacred lands and sites is a form of genocide. I met Vine when he recruited me to work with the Wounded Knee Legal Defense following the 1973 siege. I served as an expert witness at the historic federal court hearing in Lincoln, Nebraska in 1974 when Vine and a team of lawyers initiated use of the 1868 Sioux U.S. Treaty to validate Sioux jurisdiction over the Wounded Knee defendants being tried in federal courts. Vine also persuaded me to edit and publish the court testimony of Sioux elders and others from the two-week hearing, which would constitute an oral history of the Sioux Nation and its continuing struggle for sovereignty. The 1977 book with Vine's introduction, The Great Sioux Nation, An Oral History of the Sioux Nation and Its Struggle for Sovereignty, was issued in a new edition in 2013. Vine was already a best-selling author when I met him, and he published dozens more influential books and articles. He established early Native American studies programs at University of California at Los Angeles, University of Arizona, and University of Colorado. And I did several shows on his wonderful book, God is Red. Even before I met Jack Forbes, 1934 to 2011, in 1974, his 1960 book, Apaches, Navajos, and Spaniards, was central to the thesis of my dissertation on the history of land tenure in New Mexico, of Powhatan, Renape, and Lenape descent. Jack was an activist historian who inspired me to follow that path once I received a doctorate in history. He founded the Native American Studies Department and its doctoral program at the University of California, Davis, and co-founded DQ University. In addition to working together on developing Native American Studies programs, I joined him in research with the Pitt River California Nation's land struggle and with the Western Shoshone Nation of Battle Monument, Nevada. In my own political and intellectual development, studying colonialism and imperialism in Africa and the Americas and supporting national liberation movements, I found a kindred soul in 1975 when I met Howard Adams, 1921 to 2001. Howard was a Métis political leader from rural Saskatchewan, a Marxist and professor of Native American studies at UC Davis, recruited by Jack Forbes. Howard was the first academic I had met who had grown up as poor as I had, about which we had many conversations. His heartrending and elegant 1975 memoir history of the Métis and their great leader Louis Riel, Prison of Grass, Canada from a Native Point of View, now a classic, became a template of my own research and writing. An overarching narrative of U.S. history based on the historical experience and perspective of indigenous peoples, which I have attempted to synthesize in this book, would not have been possible without research, analysis, and perspectives that have emerged from several generations of indigenous intellectuals, historians, writers, poets, filmmakers, musicians, and artists. Working singly and collectively, they contribute to decolonizing the master narrative and politics that in the past have largely covered the fingerprints of centuries of genocide and genocidal policies. Thereby, they contribute to indigenous sovereignty, self-determination, and national liberation. This book benefited also from conversations with Gerald Bissonnier, and she goes on and on to name a bunch of people, thanks her editor, and typical stuff. I appreciate that this book will take its place with other volumes in Beacon Press's Revisioning American History series, and for that I thank and honor the memory of Howard Zinn. And I recognize one name in here, Wazi Yatawan. I heard her speak a bunch at the Occupy movement speeches, and she's actually contributed to the book published by All Book Books, the Unoccupy Movement. So it's wonderful the respect that she pays for the, you know, to her mentors, and also reminding people, as Zinn's book does, with, you know, quoting song The Common Man and artists and stuff, how showing how this whole wave of the what I like that phrase, the master narrative, for identifying a sort of storyline that becomes sort of like the base note of propaganda. And if you think about, you know, whether it's national or religious, or whether there's some storyline that God created the earth in 6 days, or whatever it is, that becomes a very subtle subconscious mind wash or influence that people go by. And so it takes, you know, the way the Africans say it takes a village to raise a child, it takes all these people mentioned to help bring about the change and create a new old narrative based on old truths, and yet being forged as we move forward, so to speak. So thank you very much for listening to this 6-part series, and a tip of the hat to Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and very informative and significant book, again, especially not only for showing the Native peoples and the U.S. history, but for how it so much connects to world affairs and the blueprints, be they physical or mental or spiritual, how those blueprints are still being enacted, and what we can do to change the direction. So thanks for listening. Have a good one. And we'll go out with a short track from a wonderful new CD of Native flute and other instruments: the oud, trombone, guitars, piano, drums, vocals, all put together, guided by Teokasin Ghost Horse, and it's called Somewhere in There. CD's available at CD Baby. This track is Sunrise Moon.